Hello, I was going to talk today about two different topics that we've been working on in Potsdam. The first topic I'm going to talk about is progress report in our excision efforts. Now, I should mention that black hole excision was started in Potsdam about 2 years ago by Paul Walker and Carsten Gundlach. Well, what happened later is that Paul Walker left physics and Carsten Gundlach left Potsdam. So suddenly we were left with no excision team, and the effort was essentially frozen in Potsdam for a long time. But last November we decided this was really the way we should go, so we started again working in excision. The results I'm going to present to you are from December to last week, actually. Most of the simulation was done last week. The second topic I want to talk about is some analysis we've done of the stability of this new formulation that Thomas Baumgart talked to you about yesterday, and we think we've gotten some insights into why it is more stable than ADM. So those are the two topics. I'll start with excision. So this is an approach that I call simple black hole excision. So essentially I decided to start from scratch because I didn't really understand what Carsten and Paul had done. All the code was very complicated, so I said I'll just restart them. So, okay, I started looking at the problem and seeing, well, the problem is basically very complicated, right? I mean, you have a very complicated inner boundary in Cartesian coordinates. You want to excite something that looks like a sphere, and that's really a very complicated surface if you have Cartesian coordinates. Then you have to think about what sort of boundary condition you're going to apply in this excision boundary. Of course, the ideal case would be not to apply any boundary condition at all, because due to causality, you know everything there. You don't need anything. But that might be complicated. And you have the advantage that even if you try to do something in the boundary, as long as it's stable, it shouldn't leak out, because the interior of the black hole is causally disconnected from the exterior. No, people try different things to do in the boundary. I mean, there's many different excision efforts, and different people do different things, but there are many things that have been tried. So the other thing is, of course, the question of causality. Now, the black hole, how do we make sure that we're integrating things respecting causality? So there's all these ideas about causal differencing and things like that. Then, of course, another question is, well, you might have a single black hole that's not moving. What do you do when you have moving black holes? Then you'll have moving excision regions, and that's even more complicated, though people have tried it again, and we're going to hear about that, I'm sure. So the approach I decided to take, just a very simplified approach, was just simplify as much as you can and try to solve a simple, basic problem first to see what the problems might be. So how do I proceed doing that? So I decided, okay, don't try to solve every problem at once. Don't try to do causal differencing and excision and complicated boundaries and moving holes all at the same time. Because then, if anything goes wrong, you don't know what it was. Right? So the initial step is I'm going to forget about moving the excision region initially. I'm just going to have one black hole sitting there. I'm not going to think about a moving black hole or two black holes, just one black hole. And it's sitting there. I'm going to forget about the causal differencing completely. I'm just going to try to respect causality by using upwind, simple first-order upwind. Right?
I'm calling this zero order causal differences.
Okay, zero order causal difference. Okay.
But I think if you have two characteristics going in two directions, like a general relativity, then the upwind is not stable.
I'm going to try it anyway. So that's the approach I'm going to take. I'm going to simplify the excision boundary. So basically, I'm going to excite a cube and not a sphere, because the cube is natural in Cartesian coordinates and a sphere is not. I'm going to apply very simple boundary conditions on the excision boundary and try to see what works and what doesn't. And I'm going to use from the beginning a stable evolution system and don't even worry about trying ADM, because I know that in many other cases ADM doesn't work. I have no reason to expect it will work in this case. So I'm going to start from the beginning using the scheme that Thomas Baumgart and Stu Shapiro have proposed, because that's the one we found is very stable in many other cases. So the first step is just simplifying the excision region. So basically, as I told you, I don't excite the spherical region. I excite a cube. I just make sure that the cube is well inside my horizon. Right? Of course, you might think that this looks strange, but there's no reason to think it's any strange, because we already have a cubic boundary outside. We already have a cubic topology in our grid. So why should this make any big difference? So as long as you have a consistent boundary condition, it should work. So that was the first step. The second step I was thinking is to look for simplified boundary conditions. Right? So The trouble is, of course, there's millions and millions or infinite number of boundary conditions you could come up with that might work or might not work, and you don't have any idea a priori what might work. So what I decided to do was first try a model problem, because a black hole is a very complicated system. So I decided to work with a wave equation, the scalar wave equation in 3D. So I basically just take a model problem, the scalar wave equation in 3D. But of course, you're going to tell me immediately, why do I excise there? I mean, there's no shift. There's no horizons. Why on earth do I want to do a coefficient here? Right? I still think it's a very interesting problem, because this equation has a solution that, even though it has no horizons or nothing, has a pole. I mean, the solution 1 over r of the wave equation is a static solution with a very nasty pole in it. So what I want to do is take initial data that's phi equals 1 over r, put a cube around the pole, excise that, put some boundary condition in the pole, and try to keep this initial data stable, evolve it with the three-dimensional wave equation. It's a solution. So it should, in the exact case, it should not evolve it numerically, and try to keep it stable. So that was my first approach. So I tried this problem with 20-odd different boundary conditions I could think of. And so this is the results I got. I mean, you can obviously think of many other boundary conditions, and I don't know what's going to work, but this is the things I tried. So I tried keeping the excised boundary static to the exact solution. That worked. I wasn't very surprised with that. That was stable. Then I tried doing other things, because in the black hole case, that might be very difficult to do, especially if it's moving, things like that. So I thought, wait, I'll try other things. I tried deciding just a simple copy of the field, so essentially zero auth extrapolation. So copy the field from one point outside of the excision boundary to the excision boundary in the normal direction for the cubes. It doesn't work. It doesn't go unstable in the sense of a numerical instability. What you see is that you start with your solution that looks at 1 over r, and it starts melting in the excised boundary and eventually just drops to zero, and that's it. And it doesn't converge. You do convergence test, and it does exactly the same thing at exactly the same rate. It doesn't get any closer than the exact solution. It just does the same thing. Then I tried it with linear extrapolation, the same thing. Quadratic extrapolation was even worse, because this one actually blew up. This one did, won't go unstable. Then I tried saying, OK, I know that the solution goes as 1 over r there, so try to apply a sort of Rabanne boundary condition there. Didn't work. I'm going to show you the result of those things in a minute. Tried some boundary condition, didn't work. Try a simple copy of the time derivative instead of the field itself. That worked. And then I tried extrapolating that. Didn't work. I tried many different variations of rational extrapolations I could think of. None of them worked. So basically, I only came up with 2 boundary conditions in all this exercise that seemed to work in this case. Either I keep it static, or I simply copy the time derivative.
So. Have you looked at the Grice book of the theory?
Yeah, I just tried. My approach was to try very, very simplified things to find something that's simple and robust. I didn't want to go to any complications. So this is the result. Exactly. Yeah. In the wave equation, it goes out. In general relativity, it is true. Whatever you do there will not affect the outside in the exact solution. In any numerical approximation, at any finite resolution, there will be modes that do leave the horizon. So if you do something wrong or unstable, it's going to kill you. And that's my philosophy. In the limit, it won't happen. But at any finite resolution, it will be. It will happen.
Why aren't you testing it on a null or a space like this?
Well, it wouldn't be I just wanted to find something simple in this case. I mean, I'll show you the results of a black hole in a minute, just to validate what I'm doing here.
But so the wave equation in flat space-time, you could come
in space like this. I could. I just didn't. Just thought this was an interesting test as well. I agree. I could. That's something I thought about doing as well. I just haven't done it. I mean, as I told you, I started this in December, so I haven't had time to prove all the things I might have wanted to prove. So these are results I found. So this is what I'm showing you here as graphs of the root mean square norm of the wave function as a function of time. And you see what happens if I keep the boundary static, then it looks fine. But if I do any sort of extrapolation, the linear extrapolation, the quadratic extrapolation, They melt, and then the quadratic extrapolation blows up. Now, this behavior is very similar to what you see with a black hole. So that was actually encouraging. This is the results when you do a rebound boundary condition and a slumber of a boundary condition. So you'd see that it just seems to grow linearly. This one is not that bad, but it also grows linearly. So those, so this shows it doesn't work very well. Then these are results with extrapolating the time derivative. So again, just to compare, I keep static the boundary, I get this. I copy the time derivative, I get a little drift that then stops, and I get a stable solution. Yeah. The outer boundary is static in all these runs. No, the trouble with the, I mean, you can do an analysis for the sum of a boundary condition doing going in. You can actually do an analytic analysis of that one. And then you find that because of the 1 over r factor that I put in that condition, then it's not stable. I mean, you can do a stability analysis and it's not stable. It is stable if you apply it outside, because then the 1 over r factor in the points you're looking for is smaller than in the points you know. But inside, the 1 over r factor in the points you don't know is bigger than in the points you do know, and that introduces an instability. So that's what happens. So this is to show you, does this one work? This one seems to work linear here as well. Quadratic goes unstable. But then if you try to run for much longer, so I try to run for thousands of crossing times, actually 10,000, t equals 10,000, the grid was about 6, so this is a few thousand light crossing times. The static and the copy time derivative remain stable, whereas the linear extrapolation of the time derivative eventually just blows up. So it seems to hold on for a while, but doesn't work. So, well, this was just a simple exercise to try out different boundary conditions and find something that might possibly work on a black hole. And then I decided to, well, go and test things on a black hole instead of the wave equation. That's why I didn't actually test many things in the wave equation. I just wanted to try also the black hole. So as a test for a black hole, I took the same thing everyone does. I took a Schwarzschild black hole, but expressed in Kerr-Shield coordinates. So then you have a static solution with a shift, and the slices hit the singularity, right? So I decided to take a mass of 1. And I'm actually using the Schwarzschild radius, so for a mass of 1, the horizon is at the radius of 2, and I excise a cube of size 1. So it is contained inside the horizon safely. As a boundary condition in the excision region, I use this, simply copy the time derivatives of all fields along the normal direction. As the outside boundary, I keep it static for the exact solution. As I said, I use linear upwind on any advection term that looks like shift times first derivative of the divergence of the field. Anything that looks like that, I just use simple upwind. I use the formulation that Thomas talked about yesterday, the Baumgart-Shapiro formulation. And I use a numerical method, three-step iterative Crank-Nicolson, which is stable. And then initially, but I'll come back into that in a minute, I use an exact lapse and an exact shift coming from the exact solution that I just inject, right? So this is the first result. Not surprisingly, it doesn't really work. So what you see here is the root mean square norm of the trace of the extrinsic curvature. So it starts growing from the very beginning, and it just dies here. Right? It explodes here at t equals 8m. The outer boundary is actually very close, yes, because that allowed me to run things much faster, and I'll come back to that in a minute. So the outer boundary is at 3.1, outside the horizon, but not very far away, actually pretty close. So when I saw this, the first thing, it didn't look like the boundary was a problem. The instability was coming more inside, and it looked like the problem was that the trace of k, I mean, the exact lapse and shift are okay for the exact solution, but they not correspond to something that makes the final difference in solution static. So there's a drift. And the drift eventually kills you. So I decided I was going to try a live lapse instead of a static lapse. So the first thing is I'm going to try a live lapse. I didn't want to try anything elliptic because at the moment we don't have an elliptic solver with holes, so it's should be easy to code, we just haven't done it. So I wanted to try some simple algebraic prescription for the lapse. So I decided to look for the Bonner-Mussel family of slicing conditions. So it looks like that with some arbitrary function of the last here, the time derivative of the last here. You put f equals 1 here, you have harmonic slicing. You put 1 over alpha here, you have 1 plus log slicing. Now the problem with this as it stands is that in this exact solution, trace of k is non-zero. So this would give me an evolution of the lapse, and I don't want that. I want something that in the exact solution would tell me the lapse doesn't evolve, right? So I need to generalize that. So instead of that, I actually use this. So I have this combination of terms with the divergence of the shift. The shift I still do exact from the exact solution. And this is zero in my exact solution, right? So then that would imply that if I have the exact solution, then the lapse wouldn't evolve. But if I deviate from the exact solution, it will allow the lapse to adapt to what's happening. So that's what I'm trying. This also has a nice property because this evolution equation for the lapse implies that the time derivative of the lapse is proportional to the time derivative of the volume elements. Whereas if you just use this one, that's not true with the shift, with a non-zero shift, right? But this one does imply that. So that's the one I tried. And well, the results have been beyond all our expectations. This is a black hole of mass 1, as I said. Live lapse with this factor 1 over alpha, so I'm using a generalization of 1 plus log. This is the horizon mass, apparent horizon mass. So what I do is I evolve the system every few time steps. I look for the horizon. I find it. I calculate its area. From that, I get the mass. And I plot the mass. Right? So this is the exact value of the mass should be 1. Okay, this is what I get for a value of a resolution of 0.2. So this is actually 17 cubed points because I'm using octant. So it's very few points, 17 cubed. I double the resolution, it's 0.1. You see that it's converging to first order, but that's okay because I'm using first order upwards, so that's fine, right? This goes to 50 m here, but that's because I used a very small scale. It oscillates a bit because the exact solution that you feed in as initial data does not correspond to a static solution or you find a differencing system. So there will be a drift towards something that is a static solution or the finite differencing system. And the drift oscillates the data and then settles. So, and this is what I get if I just keep evolving. As you see, it's past 3000 m. And it's still rock solid, the mass of the horizon. With this space, I don't know. There might be. Yeah. With no shift, there are. This slicing condition has as the wave speed is 1 over alpha times the speed of light. So when alpha is less than 1, then the wave speed, the characteristic speed of this slicing condition is bigger than the speed of light. So it is.
How can it be that the first order is able to follow time evolution?
I don't know, it just does.
Is there probably no time evolution in the metric?
There is time evolution. You see the metric moving a little bit from the... I mean... The metric just moves a little bit from the static solution, oscillates a tiny bit, and then reaches a stationary state and stays there. And if you double the resolution, I mean, it stops before because, of course, it takes longer to integrate, and I only run for 8 hours on our origin machine, so... Like, in principle, I guess I could just keep going. It's just that I stopped there because that's when the time in the origin queue stopped, right? The code never crashed, and it just looks as if I can just continue, right? The outer boundary is static.
No, what
rate is it? 3.1. It's very close.
How many third
ones? In this simulation, 17 cubed. In this one, 33 cubed. Second order difference in every single term except the advection term of the three equations. I looked at other things. I also looked at the convergence of the root mean square norm of the lapse and things like that, and they all seem to converge to first order, as far as I could see. So this seems to affect the convergence of everything. So. But then, as you see, this is very nicely first order, right? 3% error and then 1.5% error, and then so. Looks really nice.
Since you're just calculating the area on the innermost point with respect to the point horizon, then
Well, I expect the first order convergence is everything because I'm using upwind in the shift. So whatever I compute has a first order error that comes from those terms with the shift because I'm using first order upwind. I haven't even tried second order upwind just because I haven't coded it. I mean, these results are from last week. I mean, this graph I plotted on Thursday. So I haven't had time to try many other things, right? So. That's what I was coming to. I was coming to that.
So, yeah. So what is the form of the metric?
What is the form of the metric?
The
form of this exact solution of the metric is static as a function of time. It doesn't depend on time.
Okay, that was my question. Why is the word because the exact form is static? So is the upwind first order scheme trying to give the exact solution essentially? So that's why you stay with such a high accuracy for such a long time.
3% first order action.
Yeah, but there is, in a static solution, there is no dynamics.
Yeah, but I mean, this is the first problem most people are trying to solve. I mean, that's the first step. Yeah.
The code
doesn't know exactly that it's static. It just evolves, give it some initial data, it just evolves the full general equation.
But is the exact solution as a time dependent or not?
The exact solution doesn't. No.
Yes, this is the simplest possible situation.
Exactly, yeah.
It is
already very difficult to look at.
The fact that the exact solution is static, wouldn't matter.
That me. I'm just interested in getting an answer to my question whether the Schwarzschild solution written down as the exact solution in this coordinate system is time dependent or not.
It is not. It is static.
Not. So it is a coordinate system which respects the killing, the time
back
killing vector.
Yes.
Okay, that was my question.
It is, yeah.
And then I think it's not surprising that it stays, that the error doesn't linearly grow.
I think it's very surprising. I don't think it's, I haven't seen anyone do this before.
There's lots of ways, and lots of other people have done the calculation growing error, right? Instability.
Yeah. I mean, what it's showing is that this is stable, basically. Yeah. And I hadn't seen anybody do this stably before, basically, right? So. But of course, there is a problem, and Mijan just pointed it out. So this is the good news, and that was the good news I had on last Thursday, and I was very, very excited. But then I decided to try something else, and something didn't work. So this is the good and the bad news, right? So the good news is that if using the live labs, and that was very important, because if I fit in the exact labs, this doesn't happen, as I showed you. If I fit in the exact labs, it just breaks. But if I use these live labs, then I can obtain simulations that run past 3000M perfectly stable. But there is some bad news. The bad news was that then I decided, well, the boundaries are too close, so I'll move them far away. So if I move the boundaries twice as far, then I did encounter an instability. That's a very strange instability. It is not short wavelength like you would normally expect. It's very, very long wavelength. Actually, the wavelength of the unstable mode is about the size of my box, right? So it's really long wavelength and very low frequency.
Hmm?
32, and then I tried 64. So I'm coming to that. It only appears if I move the boundary beyond 5M. If it's closer than 5M, it's stable. If I move it beyond 5M, it goes unstable. The rate of growth depends on how far the boundary is away. So if I move it further out, it grows faster. But the interesting thing is that the frequency, both the frequency of this instability, of this mode, and the rate at which it grows, seems to be very, very insensitive to the resolution. I doubled the resolution, I got exactly the same frequency, exactly the same wavelength, but it was smaller because it has a smaller seed. I tried many different shifts and I didn't, but I'm sure it's a gauge mode, that's what I think. But I think it has to do with the laps, not with the shift. Yeah? So I'm glad. I'm glad that it's in that. So there's consistency, right? So I'm just going to show you how it looks. So it's These are two different runs at different resolutions, the 0.2 and 0.1 run. So the 0.2 run is this one. So then this is the root mean square of the lap. So you see it oscillating and growing. Then you double the resolution, you get it smaller, but you see the frequency almost matches. And if you actually look at the rate of growth, just looking at the peaks, which I did, it's not plotted here, then the rate of growth also matches. So if it was a normal numerical instability, you would expect the frequency and the rate of growth to change with resolution, and it doesn't. So this points to the fact that this is really a problem with the gauge and not a problem with the finite differencing. So I haven't had the time to try other gauges because these results are from Friday. But I did have this other graph in which I can show you what happens as I move the boundary further out. So this is the same resolution, but the boundaries are different positions. So the boundary at 3.1, stable, 3.9, stable, 4.7, stable, 5.5, unstable, and 6.3, unstable, and this is where it crashes. Right?
So why does this crash? Because the function you're plotting here looks perfectly reasonable.
It crashes almost immediately there. I mean, I don't know what crashes. And it's looking fine here, and then suddenly, boom, two or three timestamps later. I mean, here, I actually deleted the last two or three points because they didn't fit on this graph. The last two or three points that just go to infinity. So I don't know why the crash happens, but it happens. It is correlated to the size of the box. You increase the box, the wavelength increases. Static. I tried other things and it didn't help. No. This one was actually keeping the static seemed to be the best I could do. If I tried other things, it became worse. So this strange transition is something I still don't understand, but I'm pretty sure it has to do with the gauge. That's my hypothesis at the moment. But still, I'm very encouraged that 10 minutes for the other talk as well. So I'm still very encouraged that at least if the boundary is closed, I can run stably past 3,000 amp, no problem. So that's the state at which our excision effort is at the moment. So I don't know if you have any questions about this. No? Okay. So this is fine. Yeah.
If you graph the torsion current Mary said, and supposedly the Gates transformation is just R goes to R plus and this R just depends on both time and space. And then things there to see. Then you go into the equation and see what where you can come up with the evolution equation, what Einstein's equations will do with those Gates transformations. Then you can see if you were able to put it at the outer boundary, set those perturbations to zero, and the radial derivatives to zero, then you rule out this function. Usually with the outer boundary conditions that we are using, you only can manage to set up the function and not your derivative. And even if you were able to do it, just numerical knowledge would then would lift you away a little bit from that condition that we set it. And those are enough to have this exponential real node in there. The fact that you don't see it when it's inside this potential box, not really just the structural potential filtering in the world.
Yeah, that's what I was saying before.
But if you move this outer boundary further out, then they appear sooner and sooner.
Yeah.
Problem here is probably slightly more than does the static sheet that is used. Indeed, we do know that they use static light machine. The evolution is not stable for a long time, and all kinds of problems can happen when you turn this water to this light. But in this case, he is using a light lab, and he has also tried light.
I tried light shift. That changed, I didn't bring any plots. That changed the behavior a lot, but you still saw an instability with the shifts I tried. I haven't tried the right one. But I was also thinking about trying different labs. So.
More difficult. One is pretty clear that
I tried light shifts I actually came up with on my own. I just invented it to have something that was consistent with the exact solution and had a nice behavior. And actually, if the boundary was close in, sufficiently close in so that these things were stable, then the shift helped in the fact that the accuracy in the mass was higher, right? If I don't, and those runs that have a 3% error in the mass, if I turned on the live shift, the error was only 1.5% in the mass. So it helped. But it didn't help in curing the instability. So what I did is I needed a time derivative for the shift. I don't want an elliptic solution because I don't have an elliptic solver with a hole in it yet. So I said, okay, I want just an evolution equation for the shift. And I'm using the system of Baumgartner and Shapiro, so I have already a quantity there lying around it. It's not actually a vector, but it has three components at least, just like the shift, which are these gamma tildes, right? So I said, okay, I can try to fix that time derivative of the shift. Initially, just I said, okay, some constant times the gamma. That's not good because the gammas are not zero in the exact solution, so this would drive the shift away. That's not good. So I said, okay, instead of that, I just put the time derivative of the gamma here, which this is zero in the exact solution. So so that was the initial one of the shift conditions I tried. Now, this has one problem, not really a big problem, but the time derivative of the gamma, if you look at it, the equations in what Thomas showed you, has second spatial derivatives of the shift. So this actually leads to a parabolic equation. And I didn't want that because that had severe restrictions on my time step. So I said, okay, but I'll just put a 2 here. Right. And then that leads to something that looks hyperbolic. I haven't analyzed the system, so I haven't proved that it is hyperbolic. But it looks like it is, and it behaves as hyperbolic. It behaves very nicely, stable. You see waves in the ship going out and then settle down. So that's the light shift I've been playing with. So, and I don't have any other reason to use this shift, any deep analytic insights, just as something that seems to work and it was easy to implement. And, yeah.
This is very different from the kind of thing you guys are using. You would use some kind of a metric function,
yeah.
Correct?
I mean, this one has a nice property in the sense that it's sort of like a wave equation, but it doesn't oscillate around the shift of zero. It oscillates around the shift that makes this thing zero. So it oscillates around the shift that will make the gammas vanish. Not the gammas, but the time derivative of the gammas vanish. So in that sense, it has a nice property.
But it might make the coordinates oscillate so that the coordinates are worse.
It improves the problems. It actually improves it doesn't cure the instability, but it makes it grow slower, and so it improves it, but it doesn't cure it.
And also,
One approach to solving elliptic equations, if they're engaged modes where you don't need to use the solvent, is to say, okay, suppose I dampen towards the solution.
Yeah.
Then you get these problems with the time step, the intermolecule equation. But then instead of simply promoting it, as you did to a second derivative, you add the second derivative.
Yeah.
Second derivative of the term and the first derivative.
That's what Bernd was mentioning, exactly.
Right.
Yeah.
That's exactly the continual description of over relaxation is saying take the parabolic equation, promote it to a weighted equation by adding the second derivative, and then get the over relaxation. In this kind of stuff, I would imagine that since they're all gauge modes, you don't have to really relax at every step. You just work towards what you want.
Exactly right. If you were in a static regime, this should propagate any errors away, and you end up with the solution of the elliptic system. But if you have in a very highly dynamic scheme, it will just try to get there, but it'll never get there, right?
Right.
Yeah. No more questions? Okay, so I'll go to the second topic I want to talk about, so it doesn't go terribly long. So that was Thomas mentioned yesterday about this new formulation of the equations that they have. When they put this paper in GRQC about a year and a half ago, we read it, and we were very, very impressed by the results. So Bernd Brookman went and coded the scheme, and we started some tests. At the time, we were trying to evolve these very strong real waves, and we were using the ADM system and even the Bonner master system, which we coded. And with this large amplitude, even the subcritical waves, we know now that they're subcritical, then we didn't know, but even the subcritical waves with a large amplitude, we couldn't evolve past a corner time of 2 or 3, which was about 5M or something. Long before we could decide if this was a black hole or not. It would just crash. Then we took this thing that Bernd had just coded with this new formulation, and suddenly we were just able to evolve these things all the way, just find horizons when they were supercritical. If they were subcritical, just see them go back to flat space. It made a huge difference. So now that means that now we're working with that system as a workhorse, but we're very intrigued about why this thing was so much more stable than ADM. So after a while, we decided it would be a good idea to try some simplified analysis of the system. Of course, the system is very complicated. It's nonlinear. We all know that. So what we came up with was an idea of actually linearizing the equations around flat space and try to understand that system, which is much simpler, and see if there's any advantage in the new formulation versus the old formulation, right? So what we do is basically we take the formulations, we linearize them around flat space, we take laps of 1 and shift 0, just to make things even simpler, and we do a Fourier analysis of this system in time and space. So we put a Fourier mode in space, find the frequency in time, and see if this is real or not, right? So if we have a real frequency, we have an oscillation, this is stable. If we have an imaginary frequency, then we have an exponentially growing mode, and this is not stable. That was basically the idea, right? So what we do is study the characteristic structure of this Fourier analyzed system and see if we will have wave-like solutions or exponentially growing solutions. That was the basic idea. So we started with the simple linearized ADM equations, which I'm sure most of you have played with sometime in your life. So take the ADM equations, laps 1, no shift, so they simplified quite a lot already. Then put a linearized solution around flat space here. So the case I already assumed they're of first order, so I'm not going to put any extra indices on the case. So the case are first order, and the metric is just delta plus 1 first order. So I get this system now, where at this time I have these gamma functions, which at the moment are just notation, right? Don't think of them as new variables. They're just a notation to represent this more larger quantity there that has a derivative of the trace of this h, which is basically the determinant of the metric, right, in the generalized case. And you can do the same, play the same game with the constraints. The constraints actually also reduce very nicely to something very simple. So you define this new field Fi, which is this gamma minus another little term with the derivative of the traces. And then the Hamiltonian constraint only tells you that the divergence of this vector has to be zero in the linearized case. And the momentum constraint tells you that each separate component has to be constant in time. So those are the constraints. Notice that's a very nice thing about this, that if I start with a solution for which the f's are zero, which are only three conditions, if I equals zero gives me three conditions, then both are satisfied automatically. So in some way, this is telling you that the constraints in some deep way are not four conditions. Sometimes there are only three. So, but okay, that's just a little note. But so we started with that. Then we take the system we have and do a substitute a Fourier mode, right? So we just substitute something that looks like this, some coefficient here in front, and then an exponential omega t minus kx. So I did it in the x direction, but you can do it in any direction without loss of generality. Right? This is linear, so you can just superpose these things. When you do the substitution, then of course you end up with a matrix equation. So you have the omega squared times the vector, which in this case is a six-dimensional vector that has the components of the metric there, equals k squared times a matrix times h. So this is your dispersion relation in this case. And this matrix is a six by six matrix that looks like that. So it's zeros all over the place and a few ones here and there. The constraints equations, once you do this substitution, the constraints reduce to this now three conditions again. So the Hamiltonian constraint and the x component of the momentum constraints both reduce to the same condition, which is that, and the other two components of the constraints reduce to this other two conditions. So now I have this system, I have this dispersion relation, and I want to see what are the eigenvalues and eigenvectors of this matrix to get a hold of the characteristic structure of the system. So what I find when I do that analysis is that I have only two distinct eigenvalues, 0 and 1, and both of them have multiplicity 3. Right? So you have an eigenvalue 0 with multiplicity 3, and those three eigenvectors, I'll talk about them in a minute, and then eigenvalue 1 with multiplicity 3 and 3 eigenvectors. So you have three traveling waves that move with the speed of light, which in this case is 1, and three zero-speed solutions that essentially don't move. When you actually look at what I showed you before, the constraints, what the constraints meant, so I can see if these vectors actually satisfy those constraints. And I find that these two, for example, satisfy all the constraints. They're transverse, they're traceless, they move at the speed of light. So those are my physical degrees of freedom, the gravitational wave signal. Now this other one violates the constraints. So I have one constraint violating solution that travels with the speed of light as well. Then I have these other three. These two also violate the constraints, but this one doesn't. This one satisfies all the constraints. Right? So I have another mode that is in some sense physical, but if you look at it carefully, really it's pure gauge. It's just telling you an evolution of it's the evolution of the coordinate system along the x direction when you do an analysis of this one. So I have a gauge mode and several constraint violating modes and the physical modes. Right. Now these solutions, the lambda equals zero solutions, are a problem. Because you might think, okay, zero speed, they don't move, they don't do anything. Now that's not true. Because my system of equations is second order. So zero speed actually means they annihilate the Ricci tensor. That means the first derivative of k is zero, which means the first derivative of g is a constant. So that means I have linearly growing modes. So they're not things that don't evolve. They're things that evolve, that grow linearly but don't move. Right? So these things, in the linear case, grow linearly. But then let me think a bit about what would happen if I added nonlinear terms. And what would happen typically is that anything that grows linearly and has zero speed in the linear case can very, very easily become unstable in the nonlinear case. We have examples of that, and Weimer could mention a few tests he did with wave equations. But you can also see another of those most immediately, right? This is geodesic slicing. We know that geodesic slicing has focusing in the nonlinear case. And that corresponds to the gauge mode we found. So that what we know is that this gauge mode that grows linearly in the linear case, as soon as you put back the nonlinear terms, it's going to cause focusing and it's going to kill you in a finite time. So these linear modes are inherently dangerous when you add back the nonlinear terms, right, these linearly growing modes. So that is the reason. This is not a proof. This is why we believe that maybe the ADM system has very serious trouble, because it has three of these very nasty modes that can grow linearly, and when you put back in the nonlinear terms, can grow even higher than exponential, because the geodesic slicing we know kills you in a finite time. So you can have even worse than exponential growth when you put back the nonlinear terms. So we believe that's one of the main reasons why the ADM system has troubles. So then what do you do to fix this? So there's two things you can do. First, the gauge mode you cannot really eliminate because it's, after all, a good solution. It just tells you how your coronal system is moving, but it doesn't violate the constraints. So you're not allowed to play with the constraints to change its characteristics. It's just, it just won't change, right? So what the best you can hope to do is just decouple it from the rest of the equations so that it doesn't get any complications. But the other, the constraint-violating modes that have zero speed, then those you can hope that by playing around with the constraints, you can give them a finite speed of propagation, and then this problem might go away. So that's the analysis if you just look at the ADM system. If you then go back to the system that of Baumgartner and Shapiro, then we do the same, we play the same game. Now, this is a transformation Thomas mentioned yesterday, so we do that transformation. We get this new system of equations. At the moment, notice that in the evolution equation for the trace of k, I've already used here the Hamiltonian constraint to get rid of this Ricci scalar that would have there otherwise. So that's an important step. But then I get the simplified equation. This is the trace-free part of the Ricci tensor, right? And the Ricci tensor can typically be written, can be split into two parts: the Ricci tensor coming from the conformal metric, and the Ricci and terms that have derivatives of the conformal factor. So you can split it. That's very general, right? So up until here, I haven't done anything. It's just the same system that Thomas talked about yesterday. I just assumed that the lapse is 1 and the shift is 0, right, from the beginning. But apart from that, I haven't done anything. Now I linearize the system, right? So this is what happens. Now notice what happens to the evolution equation of k when I linearize the system. Now it doesn't evolve, right? So that's the first thing. If I hadn't used the Hamiltonian constraint here, I would still have nasty terms with Ricci scalar here. But if I substituted using the Hamiltonian constraint, and at least in the linear case, the evolution of this mode goes completely away. It just doesn't evolve of this variable. Right? So that already seems to be a nice thing. Exactly. Yes. There's still a problem. We've played with that system, and Thomas has played with that system as well. If you just do that, you don't get a stable system yet. And I think it's because you haven't dealt with the constraint violating modes that have zero speed. So okay, so that's what we get. Now here, this equation, I also added something else. You have essentially what you got was a trace-free part of Ricci, which is this term right here with a 1. But then I decided you can also add to this equation, and that's something that Thomas also mentions in his paper. You can add a multiple of the Hamiltonian constraint to this equation, just arbitrarily. So I just add a sigma there that tells you how much I added of the Hamiltonian constraint. If sigma is equals to 1, then I added just enough to kill this Ricci scalar. And if sigma is 0, I didn't add anything. It's just the original system, right? So this is just another parameter, right, at this stage. Then the Ricci tensor, you can now write explicitly in the linearized. Well, you could also do it before, but I'll write it explicitly in this case. In the linearized equation, it just simplifies to something that looks like that. Now, again, I have these gammas, but now there's the gamma tildes, the same as before. And notice that they are a bit simpler because now this term is not there because the conformal metric has trace 0. Right? The determinant is 0, and in this linearized approximation, that implies that the trace is 0. So it's a bit simpler. And then I can also show you the constraints, which I use later to analyze the system. They're very similar to what the ones we found in ADM. It's essentially the same thing, but now that this function f looks a bit different. It involves the phi instead of the trace of the h. Now it's the phi, which is the same thing. Right? Now, the thing that Thomas told you that was crucial, and it's true it's crucial, is now you promote these gammas, that before was just a shorthand notation, now we promote them to independent variables. So we need an evolution equation for those. Right? You get it directly from the definition, and you get this equation directly from the definition. But then you notice that the momentum constraint has precisely this term in there. So you can add a multiple of the momentum constraints to this equation to try to eliminate this term. And at the moment, I just want to eliminate directly. I'll just add a multiple, an arbitrary multiple of the constraints with some m coefficient, right? So if m is equals to 1, then I eliminated this divergence completely. But if m is different than 1, then I haven't, right? So I'm going to try and see what the effect of that m is. And then again, I do the same thing. I do a Fourier analysis of this system. So we get, again, a matrix equation for these h. Now, the only difference now is that this h now is a seven-dimensional quantity, not a six-dimensional quantity, because now I have the phi as well, right, in there. Notice that this thing should, in principle, be traceless, so that means that there's not six independent of this, there's only five, but I'm not imposing that condition in the system. I know that it should because that's the way I derived it, but then I just take the system and don't impose the condition. So that at the moment, that's still free. So what I should expect is that if I start with a mode that has trace zero in this part, then it would remain trace zero. But if I start with something that has trace non-zero, then the trace can do anything. So then I get a system with a matrix. I won't write the matrix because now the matrix is pretty nasty. But, well, I know what the matrix is, and I can do an analysis of the matrix. So the eigenvalues are actually very simple. So again, you get a lambda 0 eigenvalue, but now it only has multiplicity 1, not 3. This is still the gauge mode, which I said you couldn't really change its character, right? Now you have two modes that have a speed of m, right? And those violate the constraints. Again, you have two modes with speed of light. Those are the physical ones. And then you have these two complicated modes with a plus minus here. So they look very nasty. They again violate the constraints. And it's difficult in this case to say things general unless you start choosing special values of the sigma and the m, because it's just a complicated function, right? So what I did is I played with many of these values, particularly for the sigma, just to see what you get. So I'm just going to mention one of those values. So you take sigma equals to 1, which means I use the Hamiltonian constraints to eliminate the Ricci scalar in the evolution equation for the A's, right? So I take sigma equals to 1. In that case, those two complicated looking eigenvalues simplify to one of them just is 1, the speed of light. The other one is 2m minus 1. So I have now the eigenvalues. Now, what condition I need to impose on the eigenvalues to have a stable system? They have to be positive. Because if they're negative, I have an exponentially growing solution. So that means that I have two of the eigenvalues were m, so that I must have m positive, otherwise the system is unstable. So I cannot subtract momentum constraint to this equation. I need to add, otherwise it's unstable. But there's a more stringent condition because 2m over 1, 2m minus 1 is another eigenvalue. So 2m minus 1 has to be positive. That implies m has to be bigger than a half or equal. So if I do not use the momentum constraints, this is violated and I have an unstable system. If I use it completely to kill the trace, the divergence of the A's as Thomas did, then M is 1 and this is perfectly satisfied and I have no problem. But I could use it to kill only half of it and I should still be safe. Right? So that's what I say here. So we must add at least some part of the Hamiltonian or the momentum constraints to that equation, otherwise the system is not stable. And if you add 1, which is what they did, then it's perfectly stable, and not only that, but all your characteristic speeds are either 0 or 1, which is nice, right? So that's exactly the system that Thomas has. So that's basically what we've done with this analysis. So our conclusion is that the ADM equations have three separate zero-speed modes that can easily become unstable in the nonlinear case. And in the linear case, they just grow linearly. When you change to this Van Gaarder-Shapiro new system, we believe the stability improves because of two different things. The zero speed mode that represents the gauge mode, at least in this linearized analysis, now doesn't evolve because you have this dtk equals 0. So now it's completely killed, right? And the two constraint violating modes that have zero speed now have acquired a finite speed. So now they don't have linearly growing solutions. They have just wave-like solutions. So the problem goes away as well there. So that's what we believe it's happening in this system. Of course, this is a very simple analysis in the linear case. We don't have any idea of how to generalize it to the nonlinear case. But we think it still already indicates what might be the reason why this system is so much more stable than standard ADM.
Results or?
I don't, if you just play with that, then you're addressing the problem with the momentum constraints, but you're not decoupling the gauge mode. And that might cause problems, because Thomas has done that, and we've done that, and it doesn't improve the stability. Also, the Bonamassa system is exactly that. The Bonamassa system is a system in which they did that. They cured the problem with the momentum constraints, but they never addressed the problem with the gauge mode, and it was never stable. So we believe both ingredients are crucial.
Then, in fact, the problem that is left with the gauge is the one who understands why it gauge.
If you do that, then you've addressed the problem with the gauge mode, but then you haven't done anything with the constraint violating mode. If you do the other thing, it's the other way around. So you really have to do both. Maybe yes. If we were to impose a constraint evolution, then that things are completely different because you've changed the character of the equations, and I don't know what to say about that case.
So what does the comment on the combining the two QS comments from the Bob and Abby? That AEM system has some zero mode, and we suspect that this is the crux of the problem, and there is one evidence supporting that, namely that we can look at the linearized AEM system, and we can see that this system with the zero mode there, the zero mode are making the system weakly hyperbolic instead of strong hyperbolic. So we do expect that when we have nonlinear term coupled,
this analysis has nothing to do with discretization. This analysis just talks about the system of differential equations. I haven't worried about discretization instability. Of course, when you discretize the system, you may have other types of instabilities coming from the numerics. But this is an analysis of the finite of the differential system of equations. So this shows that if you do wrong things, for example, you take this conformal system but don't use the constraints, then you have at the differential level unstable modes, let alone the finite difference. I don't see what you mean by that. I mean, this system doesn't know anything about the constraints. I mean, the evolution system doesn't know anything about the constraints. The constraints you put in the initial data, and they are propagated. But if the initial data doesn't satisfy them, and these modes have exponentially growing solutions, then they'll kill you. Right? I mean, the system of evolution doesn't know anything about constraints. No, not because it's constraint violating, but because it had a zero speed. So the thing is, in any numerical, I mean, in the exact case, you probably wouldn't have to worry because you know the constraints are satisfied, and then this mode is irrelevant. In a numerical case, then this mode is not irrelevant because whatever you do, it's going to be there. Right? So if it was unstable in the differential case, you have no hope of having a stable evolution.
So what you could do instead is slap the constraint on it and time step.
That's something you could do. The thing is that, I mean, it might work. But I don't know, because if you do that, you're doing constraint evolution, and even in the analytic analysis, that changes the character of your equations completely. They're not the same equations. They're a different system of equations.
Well, no.
So, I mean, you change the character. No, so I don't know what's going to happen.
Can I ask everybody here this one thing about, let's start my belief that we have 3D periodic evolution and the formulation is a bit slower.
Yeah.
Pablo and Pablo and Duna are the ambassador, and they took the test on periodic evolution of the standard AEM system philosophical testing. I don't think they had any.
Yeah, that's a weird thing because it seems, in my mind anyway, that the outer boundary shooting had something to do with
seems it does, yeah. Empirically, I agree, it seems it does. And this analysis doesn't tell you nothing about boundary conditions, no.
But there was, although they did do a sitting where they talked about the determinant of the metric and the trace of the curve, it's somewhat, it is equivalent to the sense of the general.
Well, this is a very local analysis, right? It doesn't, this makes no assumptions with.
I don't know.
Your analysis applies.
It's completely local, so that, yeah, it applies.
The only applies.
Exactly, yeah, because I'm doing Fourier. Yeah, so. But of course, this one doesn't tell you it's unstable. This one only tells you you'll have linearly growing solution. So.
Well,
when you say that you're trying to do EM without seeing it, because it seems that you are evolving the linear way, low amplitude way, or depend on the topic dampening your skin, dampening.
And I would really like someone with a much more mathematical background to attack this problem and really prove things much more beyond what I've done, right? I mean, this is this is not terribly rigorous in that sense. I mean, I haven't proved stability or instability. Just in the linear case, I've done some simple tests, right? So I think it's a very open problem.
Yeah,
I agree. I agree, but this is the same thing Thomas said. I meant the York. I mean the system that.
Gauss coordinates, you see. Gauss coordinates, because what is this?
No.
3.1 split was last.
Because AGM system exists, and AGM has a specific coordinate. And it could be important for matching to real calculation for two dimensions.
All the people who do numerical work use the jargon ADM.
Yeah, I mean this
may
system.
Not mean the original thing. What they mean is.
I mean this system. Well, there's more terms with the labs, but I mean that
no,
system.
No,
that's what he means.
No.
I mean the general general case. I specialize, yeah. So what I mean ADM system is this plus the terms that come from Lapsus-Schiff. It might be the wrong name, but that's the convention normally used in numerical relativity. But it might be the wrong name. In general, no.
You have to specify
them.
No. They might be specified by differential equations.
But then it's a different system. Oh,
yeah.
What is the system we're talking about?
But we call it the ADM system with the following choice of Lapsus and Schiff.
Yeah, that's what they know.
Not
what
system.
No, he's got the ADM system with the choice of
Laps 1
and Schiff 0.
Yeah.
Then ADM should be the label, but the main system is defined by Laps 1. You just know what you're talking about. Mm-hmm. Because they exist in the system. And it should be interesting to know whether they are stable or not.
Okay, yeah, sorry. Sorry, we have 12 minutes. So, yes, whoever. Yeah.
How can you change the behavior of the gauge code other than by changing your gauge condition? I mean, your last shift. If you have some blow up behavior in the nonlinear problem because of geodesic focusing, then how can you possibly change that other than by going.
No, the mode is still there. I mean, at the end, you still have the zero speed mode that can still grow linearly because all I showed you is that the time of evolution of k is zero. But that implies that the time evolution of phi is constant. So you still have a linearly growing mode. But now it's completely decoupled from all the others, which seems to be an improvement, at least in practice. And the nonlinear problem is decoupled to principal part. Up to principal part, it is decoupled. But it's coupled through source terms.
But
so
this instability is a real instability due to the gauge, as opposed to the constraint violating thing that, would not be real if you were satisfying the equations of motion exactly.
Yeah.
These gauge motion instabilities are real instabilities due to possibly a dumb choice of coordinates. But so how can you improve that situation with it unless you, how can you do anything to the system from the analytic side other than add in multiple to the constraints? I mean, you have a system of evolution equation, I'm sorry, you have two things that you can do. You can add in multiple to the constraints for you, and that may well, you know, improve the numerical behavior when you're not actually solving the constraints, static constraints. And of course, you can find better coordinate conditions.
Yeah.
Those two things can help a lot.
But it seems, I mean, this analysis really doesn't show that, but empirically you do see, sorry.